We like to continue with our session. Please, the next presentation is given by Colby Brungard. He will be talking about from pattern to prediction, innovative methods for predicting soil distribution on the landscape.
Just a quick background to geosoil mapping. We assume that soil is formed from a particular combination of environmental covariates, and I think that we've seen this throughout the session today, and that we can predict soil distribution on the landscape by spatially representing these environmental covariates, sampling from their distribution, collecting field data, and applying a predictive model. So we were asked to map approximately 70,000 acres in Beaver County, Utah. This is a fairly typical Great Basin landscape, mesic soil temperature regime, riddick bordering on xeric soil moisture regime. Key to this, though, was that this was an unmapped area. There was no previous mapping, and the previous mapping that had occurred in adjoining areas was typically on alluvial fans and from soils that were very different from what we what we found here. So this was a fairly new area to try and map. Mostly uplands, some alluvial fans, but dominantly uplands with fairly complicated geology. The vegetation was dominantly grasses. Lower elevations, mid elevations were dominated by sagebrush and some other shrubs, and upper elevations were juniper and some pinyon. So before we went out to the field, we began to think about what soil forming factors we thought were acting in this landscape and what we could use to represent those. So we chose to use slope, transformed aspect, a measure of north and southness, inverse wetness index, and a soil adjusted vegetation index. These were all continuous variables, as well as land cover and geology, major geological type. So having those environmental covariates that represented what we thought represented the soil forming factors in this area, we needed to sample from these variables. And so we chose to use conditioned Latin hypercube sampling. This was first introduced by Minasny and McBratney in 2006. Basically, conditioned Latin hypercube sampling samples the probability distribution of all of the covariates. They've shown that it tends to be more representative of the input variables than many other methods. It samples continuous as well as categorical data. It's an algorithm that's run in MATLAB. It's fairly easy to code. Key to this is that it samples from the probability distribution of the feature space. So how does conditioned Latin hypercube sampling actually work? Well, it's based on the idea of a Latin hypercube. My figure down here, there's two different variables on the two axes, and I'm just going to show you an example of a Latin square. A Latin hypercube would just be three or more dimensions. But the two variables here are just normally distributed probability distributions, though this method doesn't assume normality. You don't have to have normally distributed variables at all. So it first divides the probability distribution of all the variables into equally probable intervals. It randomly samples inside each one of your equally probable intervals, and then it combines the samples to form a Latin hypercube, or in this case, a Latin square. And the key being here that there's only one sample in each row and each column. Thereby, one sample effectively samples different equally probable intervals. But the problem with this is that the combination of samples chosen may not actually occur in the data. So it chooses numbers basically from your probability distributions, but that combination may not actually occur. So conditioned Latin hypercube has been introduced to fix this problem. It divides the probability distribution of all the intervals, or of all the variables, in equally probable intervals, and then it randomly samples the feature space of your variables, or your covariates, and checks to see whether these random samples form a Latin hypercube. They're random samples, so most likely these samples don't meet the criteria of a Latin hypercube. So it then iteratively searches through the data and finds combinations of samples that fit the definition of a Latin hypercube, doing so with an objective function and annealing schedule. So this was based on the expected field time that we had. We chose 300 sampling locations, and this is the Each red dot up here is where I dug and described a profile. As I was out in the field, I began to wonder, how well does conditioned Latin hypercube sampling represent the variability in the input environmental covariates with different sample sizes? Basically, could it get away with smaller samples? Do I need 300 samples? So to test this, I generated 50, 1, 2, 3, and 500 samples with conditioned Latin hypercube sampling. And then we compare the sample sizes to the covariate. This is for my categorical covariate, for my continuous covariates. The key to reading these graphs, is that the thick red line is the probability distribution, the density distribution for the environmental covariate, and the thinner multicolored lines are the different sample sizes. Basically, what we can take from this is that even with a relatively small sample size of perhaps 50, we capture most of the variability in the difference in the different environmental covariates. Categorical data essentially the same. We can conclude that for each of the sample sizes, the sample is not statistically different than the covariate. So then we've shown that conditioned Latin hypercube, at least for our initial sample size and our initial assumption of 300, worked quite well to describe the variability. And so we navigated to and recorded each GPS point excavated to 1 meter and describes the soil and the landscape according to standard NRCS soil survey methods. Dominant soils in this were riddisols, some entisols, lots of calcium carbonate, lots of rocks, and some clay. So after having spent approximately 6 months in the field, having a better understanding of the landscape, I chose to include several other environmental covariates that I thought helped represent soil distribution on the landscape. So these were slope, upslope contributing area, inverse wetness index, solar radiation. We calculated potential direct yearly spring, summer, and winter, as well as potential yearly diffuse radiation. Geology, soil adjusted vegetation index, Landsat 7 band ratios that we thought were meaningful for showing patterns on the landscape, as well as the individual Landsat bands themselves. And we use these for modeling. And so our modeling that we choose to use random forests. This was first introduced by Leo Breiman in 2001. And the basic idea is that it grows multiple classification trees, hence the forest, and each tree is doubly random, hence the random forest. So how does random forest work? Well, inside the forest, there are individual trees. And for each tree, there's a random sample with replacement. This results in approximately one-third of your training samples not being selected. These are referred to as out-of-bag samples, OOB samples. And for each tree, these out-of-bag samples are used to validate each tree. This gives a running estimate of model accuracy. Additionally, at each node, there's a random selection of covariates. So I had 21 covariates that I used for modeling. At each node, three or four, it's set by the user, but three or four or five, depending on what the user wants, five covariates are chosen to split the data. And the final class, the final predicted class, is just the majority vote of the forest. So if there were two classes, one was predicted at 90% of the forest, predicted class one, and 10% predicted class two, then that final output would be class one because it had the majority vote. Random forest gives us some very useful output. We have an out-of-bag error rate, which we get for the model as well as for each individual predicted class. We have predictions, which again are just the majority vote of the forest. We have probabilities, which is the ratio of tree votes. So if we had class 1 and class 2, again, class 1 being 90% and class 2 being 10%, then the individual prediction would be 90%. And we also get a measure of quantitative covariate importance. So predicted classes. So for this area, we predicted a number of different soil classes that we thought were important for mapping, as well as several different taxonomic classes. For ease of presentation, we're just going to focus on soil depth. So depth class is very shallow, shallow, moderately deep, and deep. And this is our out-of-bag error for the model. This is a predictive model, predicted model fit. The black line in the middle is our overall out-of-bag error of approximately 60%, and the other colored lines are for the individual soil depth classes. We'll get a prediction, and so I was really happy to finally be able to see a picture after digging a lot of holes. But this agrees with our concepts of soil distribution on the landscape. Deeper soils, by the lighter yellow color, are on alluvial slopes, very shallow, tend to be on south-facing uplands. So we also get probabilities. I'm just showing two probabilities deep in very, very shallow soils. Basically, we can conclude that this is a good estimate of model uncertainty. This gives us an idea of how sure our model is in different spaces on the landscape. We also get quantitative covariate importance. And this helps us to understand what soils or what environmental factors are actually influencing soil distribution. And so from this, we can take that slope and the inverse wetness index, the IWI, and also possibly geological type, the top three, are the most important factors in this landscape for predicting or for controlling soil depth distribution. So in conclusion, condition-land hypercube sampling is an unbiased method that with samples that closely approximate the covariate distribution and does so with small, at least small for typical soil survey sample sizes. Random forest produces out-of-bag error, which is an unbiased estimate of our model error. Predictions, which agree with our concepts of soil-landscape relationships. Probabilities that are useful as an estimate of class uncertainty. Quantitative covariate importance, which help us understand soil development and also help us understand what environmental covariates may be important for predicting soil distribution on other similar types of landscapes. And so combining conditioned Latin hypercube sampling with covariates that represent soil-forming factors and random forest is a useful method for predicting soil distribution and estimating prediction uncertainty. Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes. We only used 300 samples that we collected. No, we didn't test it with those models. Those different sample sizes that we generated were strictly just to see how conditioned Latin hypercube sampling worked for different sample sizes. But the 300 were the samples that we selected in the field.
But I think a very important issue here is the numbers of samples.
Yeah, I agree with you. We've had some thoughts on how we can approach that. We haven't talked with you.
One more question, please.
What was the date of your landside image?
It was 2003, so it was before it started going bad. Yeah.
How did you do your atmospheric correction?
We used the COST method with Chavez.
So you did an atmospheric correction?
We used the dark object subtraction based on my judgment.
Like I said, you didn't do an atmospheric correction.
Let us move on to our next presentation that is given by Winsela and colleagues. It's about terrain attribute soil mapping for numerical representations of soil landscape relationships, creating raster-based soil maps and property maps.